All right, welcome back. It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, which is coming at you every once in a while now these days. I've got a glowing orb back over here. It's an odd effect. It's
kind of a halo aura kind of thing.
What I can do with that. Yeah, anyway, so we are one day, not even 24 hours post-debate, for the second debate again, you know, after the first debate again, where Biden went hurtling off into space after the debate and never to be heard from again, sort of drifting further and further out into the cosmos. And yesterday it was Kamala Harris and Kamala. I'm going to say Kamala and Kamala at some point during this because I have a Kentucky brain that cannot keep those straight. But Kamala Harris and Trump sort of squared off, and we have Dave Payne to bring us again once together the rhetorician perspective on what happened yesterday. Because there's been a lot, man. Ever since Biden exited, this has been a very interesting race.
Well, you know, last night points up, I think, the question, your description of Biden hurling off into space. The question is, what keeps Trump in orbit? What are the forces there that keeps, if you were to give, you know, anything that he's done either in the previous debate or last night, the same level of scrutiny? He would be speeding past Biden on his way to the outer rings of whatever. So there are forces holding that in orbit, and I'm mystified. Curious about what they might be, right?
Well, it's clearly, like I wrote this the other day about when I see Trump now, I just see an open faucet, a spigot of Russian disinformation that's been American washed. You know, so all the techniques are there, all the tactics are there. They've just changed the content. Like the thing, there was a meme where somebody had Putin whispering in Elon Musk's ear, the Haitians are eating cats out there. You know, and that kind of, to pull humanity down into this, oh, they're now eating our pets, dehumanizing, you know, that's straight up Nazi propaganda.
Well, maybe.
Just reworked within the American framework.
I only have a vague sense of any origins on that. I mean, somebody was saying that they, in the fact-checking process about that, that somebody posted a photograph of a man with a duck, and they had found this guy, and he said, I wasn't even in Ohio, and I don't know what he was doing with the duck. I made no claims, but apparently if that indeed is the origins datum that starts all this. But you know, at least one useful category is this is an urban legend, and what's interesting about it is it might have gone from some strange photograph to a full-blown, you know, what we now call memes, right? But an artifact of in the presidential debate. What is the conduit here, right? And what is the media matrix in which that gets to the ears of the former president and turns into, you know, and becomes part of, you know, whatever this thing is. And, you know, our conversation started with Trump's own self-styled attempt to impose rationality on that discourse. I noticed you called it a fire hose, and I think that's nice and something we've heard before, because it just shows the flow without any attempt to organize it.
Right. It's totally, like, I was watching this and I had all these metaphors or explanations for what was actually happening. It's like having letting somebody out of a mental ward scream at a rational person 5 feet away for an hour and a half. It's a fire hose versus a sprinkler. You know, the sprinkler's trying to make sense. It's got an ordered pattern. The fire hose is just like, rah! And just
but when confronted with this, yeah, Trump himself said it's the weave. And so I got interested in the weave as the organizing metaphor there. I mean, you know, what other things get woven? A web of lies.
Exactly.
But that itself imposes a little more, you know, structure to it than you said, the mental ward. Well, okay, what were you in for? I think maybe has some bearing on what the pattern, if there is one, to. So I'm curious about the weave, and he claimed that English professors had told him that it was a brilliant new speech style. And
right.
As an academic, I thought that the most incredulous, that Trump has English professor friends. I find that completely unbelievable.
Yeah, that's quite a claim.
However, having worked with those people, and with all due respect, for many, many years, and acknowledging that there would be speech professors that would befriend Trump, but I don't know of any English professors that are not pretty liberal. But they don't know much about oral communication.
There's speech professors? There are enough conservative speech professors that they would hook
up? I said there are speech professors, yes.
Really?
Yeah, there are. Absolutely.
Funny.
But maybe more rare today than 20 years ago. But still,
well, maybe this dichotomy, right, of sanity over here, you know, rationality over here, and then Trump speak and irrationality over here is a good place to start for context. Like, we're used to politicians coming over and harvesting from hyper rationality, even if it's untrue. They're very ordered. Like, if you watch Buttigieg, he's great at this. He's very ordered in how he speaks. He's very organized. Like, he goes on Fox News and he has points and all this kind of stuff. And we judge that as like, that's high value speech, versus over here where Trump is grabbing fragments, he's throwing stories, he's breaking narratives, he's just grabbing whatever and throwing it out, you know, like, and it seems like a certain amount of the population understands that kind of speech rationality versus this, you know, speech or irrationality versus this speech rationality.
Well, what is the rationality, or really the rationalization that is going on? And I'm gratified, and this is a little indulgent because I've been sort of preaching this for a long time, that the critical models and metaphors we use to explain these things very often legitimize them. They impose rationality where there is none.
Right.
And this had occurred to me somewhere in the Reagan years that even in our own academic critiques, that we have this rational model of discourse. Well, it must make some sort of sense. It happened.
Right.
And when we use those to reinterpret these things critically, we are sort of saying, yeah, they had influence. They're important. They've made it, you know. Well, just within the last week or so, I'm hearing journalists now talk about sane washing.
Yeah. Which and is a perfect term for it. That's perfect.
And which is, as we begin to sort of try to explain this, we have to piece it into a rational message before we can then argue with it. And in that doing, even if you want to argue with it, you're making it sound as though there's a meaning there that maybe is not there.
Right.
So I think that's a lovely sort of growth moment, I think, in understanding punditry, minimally punditry, and the role of the discourse about the discourse, right?
Well, even if you think about during the debate, if the moderators had used Trump speak to ask the questions versus rational speak, and they're hyper rational, they're very ordered, very careful, you know, and they give a little, you know, frame around it. If they'd have come back and just babbled, you know, and thrown that forth as a question, Trump could have easily kept that conversation going. He can do babbled dialogue. Now, Kamala is going to turn it back into rationality, pluck something out of there and go, well, that was crazy. Let's talk about this one piece here. So it is this kind of dueling babble speak logic versus ordered, you know, sane washing. And if you can't bring it into the framework of rationality, then they literally don't know what to do with it.
Well, I think maybe you or we should try to script what that might look like if the interview were conducted in the same psychotic mode. And I think you'd probably come up with something that looks a little bit like French absurdist theater, right? Ionesco or something, right? That you can barely sort of only momentarily hang on to the joke, for want of a better word, that's running through there, or the absurdity, right? Whatever.
Yeah.
So it is hard to imagine if, you know, that once again, and with the fact-checking mode, which sort of brought the journalists, the moderators out of their bystander timekeeping itself is not an antidote to, you know, it didn't stop me for long, right?
Not at all.
Like, actually, it was just an invitation. It was actually just an invitation to talk longer.
Yes, I even yelled at the TV at one point, cut his mic.
Right.
Because they kept reanimating his mic.
So, yes, a question to him that comes from the rational universe simply became another opportunity to rant. Turn on the fire hose again until they go, if he puts it out, I guess.
Well, and this goes to the core of MAGA's sort of worldview and its world orientation, which is to come into structure, institutions, democracies, traditions, norms, and just create havoc. And by creating havoc, that's how they grab power, because the thing can't operate unless it deals with them in some way. I mean, they're coming back up now, you know, with the GOP saying they're going to stop, you know, stopgap funding, you know, because they won't pass a law that says illegal aliens, you know, can't vote. And everybody's like, well, Stein says they already can't vote, you know, but the GOP is like, no, that's a havoc point. And anytime they find a havoc point, they just drive it home and just get as much juice out of it as possible until it goes back to rationality. But if they didn't have a rational system in place in the first place, it would just be chaos everywhere. There'd be nothing to, you know, for them to actually react against.
Sure. And I think that's where we started, what, 9 years ago or something, with this as a kind of a disruptor that presumes a normalcy that then it is a secondary or a corrective protest kind of mentality. But I think somewhere we, at least Trump did, I don't know about everybody, and maybe many of his followers passed through the looking glass to where this is a composite of some sort of conspiracy, you know. I mean, Trump's answer to the question about the pet eating Haitians, the challenge to that factual status was, I saw it on TV.
Right.
This guy was complaining about it. So, you know, we now have a standard. We at least have some footprints. And of course, that was a preferred truth to the city manager's representation, which he quickly dismissed as, oh, well, that's an institutional apologia for that reality. That's by definition in our world not true. He has an interest. Any sort, we've talked about this before, any sort of bias is evidence of falsehood, right?
Right.
Any potential theoretical.
Like, that's it. We're done with
the
that.
The city manager must be lying here, because somebody was on, you know, not now think about it. If you go to any community in America, I assume you're going to find somebody who's willing to go on camera and tell about what they think happened to their dog. I ironic only because the most recent member who joined Trump, RFK Jr., has publicly confessed to eating dog, but
and bear and whale and
anyway,
I guess that's the other thing too, though, is that maybe that's a better way of framing it, is over here's rationality and over here's like English professor logician hyper rationality, and then there's Trumpian kind of craziness. But then when you move over into RFK level craziness, they can't same watch that. It doesn't seem like even with that they can go, oh, yeah, well, that's just RFK being RFK. He's got a brain worm and he, you know, killed a bear and threw it in Central Park and all this kind of, you know, like they can't, like, and Trump never goes all the way over there. He doesn't really hang out in fully, completely unwatchable land.
It clearly it doesn't bother him, but, yeah. You know, I think Part of what we have to account for is the repetition of these things and the mediation of these things, where they, you know, how do people themselves consume and interact with sort of the bank of, you know, and we know that you know, this wasn't the first, maybe for many audience members, this was the first time they heard about the Haitian thing, or maybe this first time they heard some of the other claims about live babies being aborted, right? And so those were the two of the three things that got fact-checked. But that's something that Trump and Vance have been repeating over and over again. And undoubtedly, they got it because it circulated the internet in a certain sort of, I don't really want to call it dark web, kind of, you know, when they started looking into QAnon, which is a relative of this bundle, let's call it I call it a giant lint ball of folkloric internet memes, right? It sort of just collects whatever, you know, the Haitians were the sort of the today's pickup that gets assimilated into the mess. So if one were to want to analyze what's coming out of the fire hose, you might start with, you know, just tracking each of these little clearly this bundle, this rhetorical bundle has been accumulating throughout the speech acts of the campaign, as any speakers does, right? You sort of get this stump sort of stuff. And when stressed, you're going to rely on that pretty much, right? And that was kind of clearly what happened last night was, you know, you just sort of identify the topics. World War III, decay, you know, what gone and on, each of them have their own kind of history that may or may not even be important to know, only that it sort of accumulated in the giant lint ball of folkloric mythic, and got repeated enough to be, you know, a discourse,
right. to pop into Trump's brain enough to where he's like, oh, I'll try that.
Yeah, that almost describes too much rational choice making.
That's true. Or look what just popped out of my mouth. I'm curious.
Anyway, something like that as a.
I'm curious as to what you thought about and what you think about this as a technique or a counter tactic. That, like, I was just playing around with this morning as a comedy writer. Like, I don't write political and daily jokes anymore for a living, but I still like to do it every once in a while just because it's so rich, you know. And the morning after a debate, like all the comedy writers writing for talk shows and things like that are just, you know, just the air is electric because there's so much that happened to play around with. And like Harris did a little bit of comedy counterpunch where she would look at him and like, this guy's crazy, and she would laugh a little bit. And she almost, you know, insulted him when she's like the former president.
Yeah. Nice.
So she did a little bit of comedy counterpunch, but I'm like, what do you think it would be like if they let me kind of program her with some real comedy counterpunch? Like if she just said, well, maybe the Haitians are eating these babies, you know, that are being aborted, you know, and killed. You gotta just feed those to the Haitians and save your cats. You know, that kind of ironic amplification of the crazy thing that he just said. Like, I just wonder sometimes, like, if they just had really good comedy counterpunch for him, if it would just explode his brain.
So you're both of your suggestions so far, if you don't mind, seem to involve, don't rush in too quickly to reimpose sort of the consensual rational frame.
No, pushing further.
And as an edgy comic, I think that's probably interesting to toy with, right? I don't know about the political consequences. Can humor be constitutive? Can it build the structure rather than simply react? It's sort of,
well, it's like, you know,
baby in that bathwater.
After Trump's inaugural speech and, you know, the whole little incident of Bush leaning over to, I guess, Hillary Clinton saying that was some weird shit. You know, that's a comedy. You know, criticism. That's taking it and going, here's a whole new frame for what we just heard. And he's a comic character. Bush was already a comic character.
Sure.
You know. So I just wonder sometimes if I could give some real clean architecture to it, how useful that would be. And pushing him, like I said, pushing him instead of trying to drag him back into this. the same world, just pushing further and further to make him seem more and more crazy.
Well, I thought unless you're kind of living out there on that edge somewhere, last night should have been sufficient. But how much farther do we need to go? I guess is the
He wasn't that much different than his usual Trump. He's lying more. Like his exaggerations are getting bigger. Like the whole saying 90. Did you see him in the spin room afterwards where he's like, the polls are already saying I won. We got 92% and 88%. And people are like, where are you getting those numbers?
Right. Well, back to my original question. What then are the forces that are keeping Trump from spinning out of that orbit already? What we already have, odd enough content. When you were setting up a minute ago, the spectrum there to RFK on the far side of this, and now just with the Bush quote and Trump at a certain point. Notice how the move that got made, the most recent, is that's just weird, which nods in that direction, I think.
It drags it back completely out of rationality over into, you can't even explain these people.
Which is kind of a nice move. I'm not going to, and that commensurate with the kind of the more erudite sane washing. We're not even going to try to sane wash this, right? We have to be cautious about imposing this rationality stress. So maybe we're kind of slowly getting there.
What do you think about, because Walz is a really interesting character for that, because he's so Midwestern, so centered, but it's not like the erudite, Californian attorney general over here. He's speaking Midwestern against the insane world. And that contrast is where the weird came from, right?
Right.
Like him
right.
saying that as the ultra Midwesterner, to indict them with weird is like a huge sin in the ultra Midwest.
Yeah,
right?
I want to go to Thanksgiving dinner with and not have to get into some wacko conversation. Somehow you've taken away some sort of consensual reality that allows me to get along with my family. That's a kind of a nice signpost.
That's awesome. No, as soon as he said that, I'm like, oh yeah, this guy's, he's going to have a lot of those, because he's, I don't know anybody else who's come at with that rhetorical repertoire, behind him, and the foot, I play, coach football, and I'm this, and this, and it's just uber Americana.
Yeah, well, I think in terms of discourse analysis, you've touched on something, the regionality of it, because I do think that Democrats have for a long time suffered from this kind of mid-Atlantic snobbery that, they keep trying to advance a Massachusetts liberal, and they failed every time, right? They failed every time. And California's too far off the other coast, right, to bring into, because otherwise, who can talk it up a stump better than Gavin Newsom?
You were saying before you had an insight into Gavin Newsom that I think is probably accurate. He's so Californian that he's
Well, anyway, he looks like he may have been enjoying the legalization issues, but I have no data on that. At any rate, and
yeah,
once
a little
again,
bit of data, the red eyes and the smooth patter and the kind of like, whatever you got, man, it's all good.
Okay, well, you outed me. You outed me. Anyway, of course, Kamala is suffering from that same kind of attempt to marginalize in that, San Francisco. Oh, my God. So you're right to identify, is there a Midwestern idiom here that is kind of a great sort of shared center normal from which to, I'm reminded of why do all newscasters come from like somewhere between Nebraska and Indiana or Iowa? It's because of their dialect, actual speech dialect is the most neutral. And therefore, it's kind of like O negative blood or something. It's, I think maybe there is this kind of good sense attitude that also And you know, maybe that will make the difference in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. I mean, she's made really good use of him so far. Like he's right there next to her all the time. His response afterwards, again, he's very cogent and very well spoken, but it doesn't go over into the erudite at all. It just goes into very trenchant, concise, hard focus criticisms of these
Well,
guys.
at any rate, we've got it. We've got some discourse here that is kind of doing normal to weird, sane to not so much. So I think we are sort of struggling to find that critical vocabulary that helps us put it. And of course, there's been a ton of psychological pathology that is kind of hard to mainstream, but it's certainly around if one's paying attention. Yeah.
Yeah, what are the as you play the rhetorical paintball game, like where you're going and you shoot paintballs at everybody and you're trying to get the emails, like the emails are such as it just stuck to her, just splattered and would not go away. Like, what are the ones that are now sticking to Trump? Like, was the dogs and cats RFK-esque enough that it's going to stick? Like, he says so many crazy things or so many outlandish things that people just ignore it now. Like it doesn't stick. The next day he's saying something new. But the ones, if you get someone to stick, like the Arlington thing, I was surprised that they didn't bring up last night. Maybe it's because people don't really understand what that, was. But the fact that he did a photo op in Arlington Cemetery seems incredibly staining for a, guy who wants to leave
I
the
think
country.
it's probably just too much explanation to for the you know in fact there was kind of a moment there when Harris went off on Trump inviting the Taliban to Camp David, and she did a long soliloquy on
Like people know what Camp
this
David
is
is.
sacred space. And, I thought, well, okay, it's a little over the top. I don't think everybody can. You could tap it on the head, but it's the same kind of event. But was way too much trouble to craft
I bet 70%, 80% of the country doesn't know what Camp David is,
and
right?
there's so many better, there's so many better opportunities that just saying that Trump negotiated the deal whereby 5,000 Taliban prisoners were released without consulting the military or Congress, just the day before on MSNBC, a retired admiral presented a letter signed by ex-military, upper echelon people about that precise thing. They're endorsing Harris, and the reason was, and in his their letter, they talked about how much Trump was accountable for what happened in Afghanistan, and she could have easily cited that,
Right.
and among and in that was of the 5,000 prisoners that were released.
Well, I
And
will say one of the again, I think when you deal with MAGA and you deal with Trump and you're trying to counter program the rhetoric, it's these high point buttons, and one button word that I think is going to come back again and again, and I don't know if it was super designed this way by our team, but Poland. Most America still doesn't understand that Ukraine is Europe, it's as Europe as France and everything else. But when she said Poland, like, what are you going to take, give him next? Poland? Everybody, all the World War II rhetoric, all that training of, came rushing in.
Well, we know the Polish are worried about it, right? I mean, if anybody's paying any attention at all, which unfortunately they're not enough to do. But I thought that was a pretty good moment. Talk about the 800,000 Polish people in right, Pennsylvania about what you're going to do when he's sitting in Kiev.
Yeah,
So I
if they
think
hit that
that was
again,
pretty effective. Yeah.
like I said this very early on in the Ukraine thing. I'm like, so if Trump had just invaded France, or if Putin had just invaded France instead of Ukraine, would you guys be like, oh yeah, well, he felt fear because, France was in NATO. Like, that's ridiculous. But we didn't have a narrative for Ukraine, so it wasn't the narrative potential to turn that, into a major asset is gone. But Poland, man, they ought to just keep saying that. Like, just because it just imprints Hitler on him without having to say Hitler.
Yeah, and I think once again it appeals to every traditional Republican in terms of national security understands NATO, understands that. I don't know, younger people maybe not so much, but I think you're right. But I think she succeeded quite well in pushing him about his position on Ukraine and how are you going to do that? What are you going to do? What are you going to give away here? And he had no good answer except what's obvious. And then when she said, and Putin's going to eat your lunch, I thought that was a pretty much a high point of, it appealed to all of my senses of what's true anyway.
Yeah, I did too. I mean, again, I don't know how it plays out the rest of the world, but I'm looking for very, very simple buttons, that you can just pin on him that he can't get rid of, that he can't just, next day, new suit, forget all that. Let's go, with more crazy.
Well, as we try to style a frame in which we understand, and maybe we're intuitively correct here to sort of say, or maybe Tim Walz is, let's just call that weirdness, and it's their job to make it make sense. That we don't want to completely, once again, I think that the temptation is to sort of say, gee, that's the new thing, and we're going to have to, deal with that. But you mentioned Mayor Pete and his argumentative style, which is incredibly logical and clever and is capable of reversing and expanding the perspective. Let's not discount that traditional decent argument with traditional decent facts really still works. And I found myself craving more. I'm certainly not the standard consumer, but I think there were opportunities there to, talk about how much has NATO donated to the war effort,
Right.
and things like that. That more sleds full of factoids could have bolstered a lot of these points. The moves were good.
Yeah. I don't know. Can you counter program that kind of sheer irrationality, propagandistic irrationality with hyper rationality?
No, you can't. You can't reprogram it. It is a completely self-sustaining system. All you have to do is sort of say, once again, the city manager has a vested interest in not believing my truth. So no, you can't, because it is a self-bolstering system. That's what makes it more of a psychosis than an argument. These things all lean on each other like a house of cards, and they're meaningful to only those inside the code. So no, I don't think, I mean, there's I'm reminded of the famous Freudian case of the wolf man, because he had, right, built perfect defense networks all around every entry point into his pathology, right? That Freud couldn't, there's no entry point. Okay, so that's really what's operating there, is closing up each and every possible entry point for a rational, factual basis. And to where you come along saying, it doesn't matter, what the facts are. It's whether people believe it or not. And can I get people to believe it? And Trump has pretty much said that out loud, I think.
Yeah, I
As
agree.
did Goebbels, I believe. But anyway,
That's what I was saying. It's
exactly.
all grabbed from the Nazis, rewashed through, the Soviet Union, and now it's living in America with American, masks and re changing the terms.
So let's get real. No, you can't reprogram that, but you can compete with it, we hope. Right.
Can you compete, like, once it takes somebody over, like, I've worked a lot of this, but how do you deprogram that? How do you retrieve people once their brain is has absorbed that much propaganda coming in? Because rationality doesn't do it. Like, that's why everybody loses their minds in conversations with family members, is because arguing into that swampy kind of, propaganda logic is just infuriating for anybody that has, decent rationality. So, like, the idea of, like, if I just shine a clean enough beam into the swamp of their minds, it will start to move things around and recover them. I'm not sure that's the way.
Well, I think that's a different problem. Okay, that's a different competition, I think. I mean, let's step back and get real. The most important thing last night was Taylor Swift's endorsement. Okay,
Yeah, I guess
I
for
mean
like.
that Taylor Swift will, and she made logical arguments or gave good reasons, to coin an old rhetoric phrase, gave good reasons for her position there, and those will be reasons that other. Let's just focus on for the moment 18 to 30-year-old females can give and identify with, and maybe provide enough motivation to get them to the polls, and that might make the difference. And so that's certainly a different cultural ball, if you will, that can work and play along with Mayor Pete, that work and play along with, you know, Kamala and the other kinds of things she said. So there are these entry points into the worldview. You're talking about deprogram, you know, what are we going to do with the 47% that are going to think this even if Trump leaves the planet, right? And I think that's a real problem. I think that's a real problem for the legitimacy of the state and governance going forward. How did it get so big and how did it get so resilient? What are the forces holding that in place? Because I swear, my position at least has been it's not Trump nor his rhetorical prowess that's doing it. There's something else he's taking advantage of there
Oh, clearly, yeah.
that he's just the avatar for.
Well, the DOJ coming out this week, and I can't believe it's taking this long, you know, with a Democratic administration in place and actually charging some organizations with fronting for Russia. You know, this
Right.
has clearly been going on for at least 10 or more years with the internet. As soon as the internet popped up, it's an open gateway into America. And Russia's like, hey, look at that. All we have to do is create fronts, fund them, and we can get this, you know, rhetoric, this propagandistic rhetoric into America in droves and constant and with talented people. I mean, a lot of the people that they funded are very talented talent on camera. They can flow things out. Like even when you look at people like, you know, InfoWars Boy and you know, Alex Jo Jones, they're very good on radio. They're very talented people. And that's the key. Like, if I were producing this as a Hollywood producer, like, that's what I would be doing if I was working for Russia. You know, I would getting very glib, very focused, very verbal, you know, people to, again, America wash my propaganda and then just pump it out constantly. If I were on the other side and doing a creative producer work for Kamala Harris, I would get, you know, I would harvest from walls right now. I would sit him down for a week and with a bunch of writers in a room. I'm like, ask this dude questions, let him flow, and just start grabbing it when he pulls out gems. Like weird, you know, it had about a week half-life where, you know, it was pretty strong. And Trump even is still, you know, reacting to it. I'm not weird, you know. So it had some, there's a little bit of a diamond spear to it, and I'm sure he's got more, but you got to harvest that stuff, you know, and that's what I would do first as a creative producer is I always did this with talent. I'm like, you just talk. The writers will turn it into mechanical script that has uses in places. But, you know, I don't know if that's the way politics works, if they're doing Hollywood production techniques or if they're doing political production techniques.
I think probably some informal process is going on in the interviews and the you know, and then you know one place that this stuff gets filtered is in a late night comedy monologues, right? This is where it gets celebrated and you know Trump's response to that, I'm a solid Vance is a solid rock and I'm a more solid rock, that gets lampooned as so. The answer to weird becomes as important as the attribution of weird to begin with, right?
Yeah, but you can architecture this. This is what I learned as a Hollywood producer, is shows architect everything. Like none of it's happening by chance.
Sure.
Like when you work on a talk show, there are actually somebody has the job of guest producer. And what that means is that for any actor or celebrity or anybody gets on, they have to tell their story first to the producer before it gets on air, so that they can now program questions into it. And if it's too boring, they'll hand it to the comedy writers to punch up their personal story.
Sure.
to give them better lines. So they've got, kill lines while they're on air. And when I look at politics, and I've never worked inside of politics, I've, this podcast, and I like to,
Something new for you.
yeah, I'm not sure I want to get over there. They'd have to adjust to me. This is what I did to business. I forced, because I worked a lot in marketing and business the last 10 years, but I forced them to work with me. Like, I'm literally going to be running a session next week for a business on how to set up a Hollywood writer's room creativity for businesses. And because it's run very differently than the way businesses run creative. And politics should do the same thing, especially when you're trying to fight somebody like Trump, who's a clown. He's an entertainer and he's a provocateur. He's a promoter, like that New York promoter motor mouth that he has. He developed that for 30 years in New York. And then he started picking up TV techniques when he got on The Apprentice, where they give him script and he remembers fragments of the script. He did it last night, with the dogs and cats. Somebody came up with that, wrote it. They're eating dogs and cats and it's Haitians. Pick that one. So there's probably 200 things he could have said that are crazy in the world that they've created. But that one was potent enough. And he's got good enough instincts for what's going to create the most stir. Those are all Hollywood
I
instincts.
think that's probably, I don't know that that's written. I think it's native talent there, but I agree with your point. There's a whole new book out about the importance of Trump's career on The Apprentice. And I heard the guy interviewed. I have not read the book yet, but it was very compelling, more than I had even imagined, because I never watched the show.
No, but it's a no, that
But
training.
he basically claims that's where Trump got all of his skills and his identity for his followers is as a successful businessman, because certainly business never produced it. And
Yeah, it's all, and it's also
this is
where
what.
the morality of Hollywood is also a good place to get that training for politics because it's all fiction. Like in
Sure.
Trump, every once in a while you'll see him, even like he did a interview with a comic. I can't remember the guy's name right now, but he's a good comic. He's been around for a while and sort of young, kind of deviant, sort of bro, in that world, but he's likable. And it was the first time I heard Trump actually asking authentic questions of another human being because they were talking about drugs. And the comic was talking that he'd been on all these different types of drugs his whole life, illegal drugs. And Trump was like, well, what's cocaine do? Like, you could tell, like, he had never really done some of the drugs the guy was talking about. And he was authentically interested, present, and curious and asking questions. So Trump has that, personality. He's been trained within, Hollywood to have a Hollywood morality, which is it's all fiction. Don't worry about it. We're just weaving a story to get people to react. And so I totally believe that the training that he got on that show completely is what took him from New York promoter, which is too, it doesn't work in politics as well, and moved him into something slick enough and trained enough to do entertainment-oriented politics. Totally.
I have no doubt of it, but back to your the incipient proposal here that somehow the production of the political discourse needs to have a kind of a liaison with the comic systems, and I mean I definitely think The Daily Show and Stephen Colbert and Jimmy Kimmel and that is probably a more active, John Oliver, are probably a more active menu for people getting exposed to what happened these days. And so it becomes encased in a comic frame. And that somehow makes it tolerable and interesting, right? But
Well, and
it's certainly one of the echo chambers here. Yeah.
it's weird to watch comics try to play in the other space. Like when Jon Stewart got into the burn pits and the all that kind of stuff, he couldn't be comic. Like he went over and started being a dramatist, and he was boring. He was not a good dramatist. He was not as good as Trump is at creating the energy of drama and trauma, around something. And he just ends up getting frustrated. You could see it, and he'd be like, "How can you not fix this?" But then he went hurtling back after a certain point, over back over to the safety of The Daily Show.
You know, he was a good figure. I mean, you know, he was a good New York citizen, I guess, that did a kind of a moral shaming thing. But you're right, it was certainly not talent that one, you know,
Yeah, he was out of his idiom. He was clearly out of his idiom.
True.
But I like it. Like, this thing I like about rhetoric, too, that rhetoric, if they would actually understand the big ball of, you know, rhetorical study, could inform these things in ways that they're probably not harvesting from right now.
Could be. I think it's hard to be experimental. There's so much at stake. And I think maybe that is why Trump has been so singularly successful, is he had nothing to lose when he strolled on that debate stage.
Totally experimental.
Absolutely, and here were people who were, you know, pretty well hyper-socialized into conservative political discourse. That's kind of how he made it. I think that's how people were looking for something fresh. And once again, to tap into a certain ethos, a certain kind of incipient identity politics that was going on there. How it has become what it has become, that's a whole nother thing, I think. But
well, I'm curious, like, as I said that, and I think about your stuff, Trump's approach to failure, you know, and mortification and transform failure into success and all these different things versus Kamala Harris's, like, trying to lock her into the 13 people that got killed during the Afghanistan withdrawal. Like, how is she going to, is she going to do mortification about that? Is she going to accept that as her failure? That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to throw the border czar at her to give her some failure. You know, what would you say the process she should use, the rhetorical process? Like, she shouldn't really do mortification, should she? Like, she shouldn't accept this as, you know, a sin that she committed.
No, of course not. And I think, once again, it's a question of how does it stick? I think there are, you know, it comes up enough, the Afghanistan thing. And of course, you know, it's kind of like the Benghazi thing. It automatically represents, it is a title for the situation of having failed. And of course, the upward mobility of failure is, even though they're undoubtedly starting with Trump, and a lack of any plan to meet the schedule that apparently he set for withdrawal, to the generals, you know, the failure goes all the way up, right? So now the vice president, only because she assumed the mantle here. Otherwise, you know, one wouldn't expect that she had anything to do with the decision-making surrounding this. I don't think they call up the vice president and said, hey, how are we going to get out of Afghanistan? So there is this kind of mobility of failure, upward and downward, and responsibility, and that's just kind of the game. So, but back to your observation, you know, undoubtedly the most thematic and central point of Trump's core rant there was, we are a failed society, and that is the shared warrant, the shared perception of he and the people who believe in him most. That is the and of course Kamala countered that with you know, so she didn't accept it, she didn't answer it, she didn't dive into, you know, how did this really happen, and try to diffuse it. That's for other formats and other conversations that may or may not ever take place, or may never get to the people who need to hear it. You know, for some people it will stick, for some people it won't. But she, you know, she's countering that. And I think, once again, that discourse, her counter, will hit a wall. She countered that with, we need a positive vision of the future. I don't know that there's a better answer to the question. There's got to be some right recipe for, you know, for moving on, and diffusing that kind of thing. But at its heart, you know, and maybe she correctly analyzed or correctly saw, at its heart is that sense of failure. Whether it's immigrants eating dogs, or, right, the military not, you know, letting 13 people die and showing the picture of that airplane trying to take off from Kabul with the people, with, you know, all of those, you know, which are now symbols. They are now the condensation symbol of the holy event that is recorded as failure. So everything Trump's saying is really what holds all that together is this litany of having failed. So whether the burning cities, the defund police, so what holds the lint ball together is this consciousness of failure. Of that, there is no doubt. And that is sort of then the warrant. What you must do is get on board of something that isn't that failure.
Right. And Trump, on his side, literally doesn't admit that failure exists for him.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mortification. He does so no, yes, no mortification at all.
In my conversations with people, and because I hear this echoed a lot, well, the pharmacies are having to lock up the toothpaste from gangs stealing it, you know, on and on and on. The more, you know, each little example, somebody eating a dog, whatever it might be, regardless of the facticity or the context or any of that stuff, this rises to the level of more prima facie case making that something is fundamentally wrong with how we stand. Now, I counter that with the question of, and which one of Trump's policies do you think addresses that issue? What will Trump do that causes your pet in Ohio to be more safe? And I guess because he repeated it over and over again, deportation of immigrants. Unfortunately for that answer, the Haitians were legal.
Right.
And furthermore, the event doesn't exist, therefore it can't be repaired.
You're hitting it back with a dose of logic and logos, you know. So my question again is, like, if we just use that framework, which you're so good at articulating, you know, in your book and everything else about, you know, failure, that sure. Trump, part of his rhetoric is to never, and they even did it last night, where she hit him with, you know, like he admitted, like the question about it, you've admitted three times over the last few weeks that you lost the election. And Trump literally said, did I say that? I don't remember saying that. It was a joke. It was sarcastic. And her going, you know, the fact that you can't accept the failure of losing an election is no excuse for destroying a country.
Yeah. Well, I think you improved on it a little bit in your retelling, but that's essentially right. Yeah, you know, I mean, she shamed him. You're a disgrace. You're a laughing joke. And I think Trump was pretty much, for his version, mortified. If you go back and replay the looks on his face as what's going on, you know, it really is this toddler that's been caught doing something naughty. I think that, so, you know, I think shaming is one response. Once again, for the people who are, you know, so invested in explaining their own misery with that theory of failure, right? I mean, you know, in its most simple form, we've talked about Hitler, but in its most simple form, we have the failure of Germany due to depression, economic collapse, the loss of in World War One, the whole structure of society shaken. So the question is not just the power of Hitler's rhetoric, it's why did people buy that? Why did they get on board with that? It's because it explains their own failure to them, right? That's the point of identification here. So you can blame all of this on the Jew. Well, last night was a perfect example of blame it all on the immigrant. Yeah, I mean, that was the most, you know, 80% right. of the discourse, which is just factually impossible. You know, that just cannot be the reality at all. And therefore, it cannot be the solution. So he's doing, don't mortify, victimize. And I think, you know, she turned that table as well as it could be turned, probably. I don't know. I wish I had a better answer for you after. How do you interrupt that sequence? I don't know. Except that eventually something will break and somebody, some kind of atonement will have to happen.
Right. Well, and this is what bothered me. One of the things that bothered me about Hillary Clinton, where she would get rhetorically clumsy, Like when she, in her concession speech, the first thing she said was, I want to apologize to everybody that I've let down. You know, the little girls that look up to me. And I'm like, why accept that failure at that kind of wide open arms of, yeah, dump all this failure on me. Why that apologia? Why that mortification? Why would you take that rhetorical track when you know it's not even true? Like, and she would try to, you know, sidestep the failure by saying it was Comey, it was the Russian, you know, all this kind of stuff. But at that point, she had already absorbed all the failure. There's no way to get it out of her anymore. You know, and I think Kamala Harris, one of the things that's really useful about her is she has not absorbed 30 years of, you know, attack and slander and failure, you know, claims the way Hillary Clinton had. Like the only thing they can hit her with is things that she was hanging around in the administration while Biden was setting these policies. You know, so she doesn't, she's pretty hard to hit right
and
now.
And she answered it pretty well. We were cleaning up your mess. That's what we were doing instead of making all of these advances. You know,
certainly. So she sidestepped the failure a little bit and handed it back to him. But it is, but, it's but this what, kind of failure games.
They're
hunger games right now. They're playing failure games.
I think what Hillary's doing there, of course, is consolatory discourse. And so she's taking a posture of humility. And I think Harris took a posture of humility last night, too, but not quite the same because the context is not yet the same to say, you know, I work for you. I you know, so you've not heard any of that from the other side. When you go to his rally, you're not going to hear anything about what he wants to do for you. So I think that was pretty deft.
Yeah, I agree.
And, you know, once again, how what impact it will have or can have given the nature of, you know, these incommensurate political realities and all that sustains them, all the centrifugal and centripetal forces that that hold Trump in orbit. It's hard to say, but I think as meeting the requirements of the speech situation, not bad.
Yeah, I'm curious as to what you think about maybe the strongest direct psychological blow that she hit him with was his rallies being boring. And
that certainly is the way. That certainly is the way the pundits are covering it. That
right.
Attacking him on a crowd size was the
because he had a weird facial expression in the middle of it. She's like, oh, she really landed something there because he went
certainly uncorked that genie. I think we had the best rallies. You know, I mean, the whole rant there.
Well, and again, you talk about the training. Like, if you hit him on ratings, like his Hollywoodness comes back up all the time, where he's like, we're the most popular, we get the best ratings. You know, if you hit him on those things, then you can tell it. He's got he has internalized that enough to where it does have some psychological impact on him.
Yeah, no, I think it's just, you know, it's other people. I don't want to own the narcissist diagnosis because I'm not a shrink, but it certainly fits in terms of public character that you know, it's about him. And you've got to be the hero or the victim of every story, and that anybody would turn and walk away from that. Right. That
right.
Story.
Yeah, I'm like you. I don't use the psychological terminology and apparatus very much because I used to be married to a therapist. But I do use the Hollywooder explanation a lot, that if you want to trigger, you know, a celebrity and a Hollywooder, you do things like ignore them, not let them speak, and you just watch them explode or let somebody else have the dais in front of them. Like he had such, you know, so much of a psychological reaction to Fauci getting more respect and having more, you know, of a pulpit than he did, that he just destroyed Fauci. And that's a Hollywood psychology of nobody upstages me, you know? And I think that's a really good way to counter program.
I think that's right. And once again, it errs toward the psychological to say this, but when I hear people say, oh, Trump's, you know, he's just trying to stay out of jail. I don't think so. I think once again, he was shocked to get in the limelight, where all vectors pointed at him. This was the pinnacle, the greatest moment of celebrity you could possibly have. The president is the number one narrative in the media every day in America. And, what the president is doing today is the number one story constantly across 4 years. To imagine that he's lost that luster, that people are walking out on him, that he didn't win by a landslide. All of that is the failure of his big hungry ego, basically, right? That's the unthinkable, and that's what, you know, as much as anything motivates him to continue. I don't buy that it's there just for money. I don't, you know, nobody's just one thing.
Well, there's also a Hollywood psychology of going back to the same show, even if it's been super successful. That's why, like, you know, these Seinfeld and things like that, they end and they don't, you can feel that last few years' energy is gone because they no longer get a hit from it. They've reached as much maximum fake love from the people right. as they're ever going to get. And so they want to get out of that role. They want to move on to a new role where they can get new juice. And Trump has no new role to go to. You know, you can feel like that's why I think like the last 6 months or so, he seems so tired. You know, he seems like he doesn't have the energy to bring to these things. He's kind of a walking, you know, numb feeling to him. And I think it's because there's no psychological juice left in these wins.
Probably so. But there's no place to go.
No, he's got nowhere else. Nothing.
Your Hollywood. I don't know if you've seen the show with Michael Douglas and Alan Arkin. Not Alan, but yeah. Anyway, the
Alan Arkin.
Method,
yeah, but.
Anyway, where he's an ex actor, but who now gives acting lessons. But he wants a role. He wants a role, and they get him to sell reverse mortgages, right? And this is. Right. What stop is that on the way out the door, right? And that's
it's a tough psychological.
So other politicians could be elder statesmen. They could start a foundation, you know.
Yeah, but yeah, none of that's nearly as vibrant as what Trump wants. So yeah, I don't think he's got anywhere to go psychologically. So it's going to be interesting to see these last 2 months. If he can. Once again, sort of conjure the energy that he needs to push these narratives, because it just seems like he's just going through the motions at this point.
Well, whatever sparked him last night did spark considerable energy. I do think there was authentic passion.
There was anger, and hate,
that
things
could
like
be
that.
It, yeah.
He's good at portraying those things. He knows about four emotions and he uses those all the time. But again, these are actor things. Like, he's just on autopilot, it seems to me. As somebody who's directed people, you can kind of see the difference about whether they're there and they're bringing their real sort of charisma energy, or whether they're, you know, just relying on technique at this point. And he seems to be relying on technique.
So you think the whole kind of spiel, the final spiel about the end of society and the country and World War III without me was contrived and just performed.
I think, you know, almost everything that he does is contrived and performed.
I mean,
think
in a way, I would be comforted by that, but
I think they run a lot of script by him, because you do this a lot with talk show hosts. Like, you run, like, on day of production, you'll run 75 jokes past the person. And then they'll pick the 20 that make them react, or they'll pick the 20 that during rehearsal make the camera people react. So they don't care. And a lot of them don't even have good radar. I think Trump has good radar for being a dick. You know, I think he knows how to create conflict. He knows how to push at sore points. And he does it, you know, without conscience, which again is an actor. Like, actors don't care if they're playing you're playing an evil villain, you want it to be the worst villain ever. You know, you want people to hate you because that's where you get your juice. And so I think they run a lot of script by him, and he just grabs onto things that he thinks will be the most inflammatory. And if he has anything, like to me, like his advantage forever has been that he's got all that training, whereas almost nobody else in politics does. Almost nobody has that kind of deep, multi-year Hollywood training.
Well, I think what you might be suggesting is the passion of the force behind it comes from a different place than the truth of. I think you're right. I think he just says the words, and I think he says them over and over again. And so, and that's the point of the rallies where he has immediate feedback. I think without an audience, he has no.
Yeah, it's live theater versus you're doing it on a set.
So I think that probably, but I do think you're right. Probably the anger, embarrassment, the sense of something slipping away. If only I could, make the case that, the performance requirements here, had nothing. It's not the passionate truth of what he's saying, which I don't think is ever really a category for him. I don't think that even matters.
Really, really emotion, positive emotions like that, passion, none of that. It's all anger and hate and despair and shame and, aggrievement, all that stuff. I think for, again, my experience with Hollywood actors is those are the emotions that seem to continue. The depression, all the need to the only way to cut through where they're caught, what they're caught in, this kind of dark whirlpool, is super love. And that's adulation from massive amounts of strangers. And so they chase it, and they chase it, and they chase it. I see this a lot with stand-ups. And ultimately, even when they get it, it fades pretty quickly. There's a great stand-up name, I can't remember his name right now, but he's Doug Stanhope, who used to say, like, yeah, when you get to a point in your career where if the audience is just laughing at everything you say, you're like, they're idiots, and it's too easy. And if they're not laughing at anything you're saying, you're like, they're idiots. They don't understand the jokes. So there's never a sweet spot. You're always unhappy. And I think that I can see it a little bit in Trump's eyes these days. Hopefully it'll psychologically end.
I do think that is probably, if you were his friend, you would say you really have no happiness system here. There is not a happy
Yeah,
and
you're
once
living
again,
on adulation.
opening
That and
yourself up
that
to the masses is,
that's a toxic diet. Well, cool,
absolutely.
man. I again, always super fun. I think the mortification thing really interests me right now. If they're going to be able to give any of that and force Kamala Harris to react to it, or whether she's going to be able to stay with America the positive, America, the future, and hey, we're not going back to this dark crap that you want us to. Because that, when it comes down to it, I was like, America the positive or America the negative? Which do you want?
Right. Well, if you get back to just the way the pundits were reading the nonverbals, Trump is hunched over. He's squinting. He looked old. He looked tired. He looked, angry. These are all mortified postures. And I don't think you're supposed to display that. And of course, it killed Biden, although in a quite different way. At any rate, interesting stuff.
Well, we'll come back and visit this again next time some cataclysmic thing happens as
Where we maybe
well.
we'd be cursed to have more.
Yes, I have no doubt we will have more.
All
So,
right, Dan.
all right, super fun. That's Dr. Dave Payne, Rhetoric Warriors. Come back, check it out. We'll be here off and on over the next 2 months until we get a president.